One thing's for certain, kids love to ask questions. And the question about where does money come from can be as tricky as fielding one on the birds and the bees. That is why this edition of On Your Money is focused on how to teach kids financial values that will stick. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is away. Let's welcome author Jane Pearl, who focuses on family business and financial parenting. She co-authored the book Kids, Wealth, and Consequences, Ensuring a Responsible Financial Future for the Next Generation, and has co-authored other books. She started her career at Forbes and was former senior editor of Family Business Magazine, to which she has contributed for more than 20 years. She's written hundreds of articles about family business, financial parenting, personal finance, and business management. Jane, welcome to On Your Money.
I'm so happy to be here, Kate.
Well, here's the scenario. A mother recently shared on Facebook she charges her 5-year-old daughter $5 out of her weekly $7 allowance, each dollar going for rent, water, food, cable, and utilities. So what do you make of this scenario? Is it good parenting on the financial end?
Well, I think the mother has the right idea by basing allowance on financial responsibilities. Because when allowance is based on chores or grades or other types of behavior, I think it's a setup for some other complicating problems. For instance, if she were to say, for your allowance, your chores are going to be maybe setting the table or feeding the cat, and the child says, I don't feel like doing it, dock me. Well, where does that leave the parent? The parent is not going to be giving the child the financial capital that she needs, learning capital, to learn how to manage the money, and the table won't get set and the cat will go hungry. So same thing with grades. I mean, it's as complicated. If you have two children and one gets an A without studying and one, you know, gets C's but works really hard, how do you reward them or not for their accomplishments? And so I like to base it on financial responsibilities the way that this mother, Essence Evans, did. But I think it should be more age appropriate. The financial responsibilities would better be based on things her child can relate to more directly, like school lunch, maybe shampoo or other toiletries. And so a mother can say, okay, this is what I spend per month pretty much on these few things, and I'm going to give her an allowance of that much, you know, whatever that equals per week, plus a bit for saving, maybe for charitable giving, maybe for her to contribute towards friends and relatives' birthday presents if she goes to parties. So these are things that the child will relate to, and I think the mother's got the right idea.
Well, you get into some elaborate formulas for playing around with what is a reasonable allowance this day. You can look at inflation, you can look at consumer price index, lots of different factors going into what the value of that dollar and what makes an appropriate allowance at various stages of childhood. Can you talk through how we should go about setting an allowance?
Yeah. So again, you can sit your child down and say, these are some of the things that it costs to, you know, keep you going, you know, at school and in your sports. So 5 is pretty young, but say the child is at least 8 and over, it gets a lot less complicated. I mean, in a way it gets more complicated because there's more things. So if the child is involved in sports, so maybe hockey pucks or tennis balls or soccer socks, you know, these things are got to get regularly. They don't cost all that much, but it's also good because you don't need them every week. So the child has to make sure that they save enough, and the parent has to provide enough money that they can cover that so that when it comes time, they can get it. And there have to be real consequences. That's the other problem with this. If the child is paying for things that the mother is just taking away, the child isn't actually learning how to save. The mother's doing a great job saving. In fact, I think it's better for her to be more disciplined in saving for her child than it is a learning opportunity for the child. But So if they don't have enough money for tennis balls, well, guess what? I'm so sorry, but you didn't save. You spent all your money on candy or CDs or whatever. And I just, you know, you're out of luck.
Well, ultimately, that kid still wants to go to tennis, still has every inclination to go hit that ball, or regardless of whatever sport, or needs those dollars to be backed by it. Is it hard for the parent to keep up their end, because they know they could help out that kid at any moment?
Well, you've just put your finger on the very key. Because in order for this to really be a learning opportunity, the parent has to be able to be disciplined herself and himself by being consistent, being clear, and having consequences, following through. If you have to explain right up front, if you don't save enough, and this is what soccer balls or guitar picks or guitar strings or reeds for an instrument, whatever, this is what it costs, and you need them every whatever period of time you would guess. So it would make sense for you to save this much out of your allowance, but you want them to make the choice because that's how they learn.
Jane Pearl is with us. She focuses on family business and financial parenting, co-authored the book Kids, Wealth, and Consequences, talking about bringing up kids who understand money and getting your questions, your insights, your ideas. 800-642-1234. Do you or would you make your child pay rent? Why or why not? How much do you make them pay if you do? And at what age do you think children should be taught financial responsibility? When does it really start sinking in? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jane, why should children care about financial responsibility at an early age? Why not let kids just be kids?
Well, you should let kids just be kids, but this is part of it. I mean, their lives depend a lot on money. I mean, they see things all the time and get messages that parents would be wise to make sure they're getting the right message. For instance, imagine that 5-year-old daughter in the car. Her mother drives up to an ATM machine, puts a piece of plastic in, pushes a few buttons, and out comes some $20 bills. Well, to that child, without explanation, it seems like, oh, mom can just push some buttons and get money. But it's a wonderful opportunity, which doesn't require any extra time. You're right there in the moment. And you can say, you know, isn't it interesting that I can take money out of this machine? Well, guess what? I had to put money in first, and the bank keeps it safe and it makes it available when I need it. But I can only take out as much as I put in.
Well, that's also a very difficult conversation, because it's hard for kids to understand what is happening when they see a swipe of a debit or credit card at the grocery store. They watch the transaction. It just doesn't seem to equate. So teaching kids about money in the age of screens and plastic can be really tricky. It's hard to count out money when there isn't cash around. So how do you do this?
Well, I think a lot of it is just talking when you're out and about making transactions, for instance, or when you're home and the credit card bill comes in, and you can say, oh boy, I have a choice to make. I spent a little more than a lot more than I intended, and or that I can afford to pay off and completely this month. And that means I have to pay interest. I have to pay a little bit extra if I don't pay at all. And that adds up, and that makes the cost of everything I bought last month go up. And so you talk to them about your decisions. I think one of the worst things to do is not talk about it at all, to treat the subject of money as taboo. And believe me, they're getting messages from the media, they're getting messages from their peers, they're getting messages from the commercials and programs they watch with product placements. So parents have to counter that. And the number one indicator of success with children, there are actually two things, I think. One is, how often do parents have dinner with the children? There was a study done of children at very wealthy families and children at the low end of the economic spectrum. And they found that the number one predictor of at-risk behavior of all sorts was whether the parents had dinner with their children regularly. We have such overscheduled kids, and adults are so stressed out with all this multitasking. It's very hard to just sit down and have a calm dinner. How was your day? How was your day? And you can include some issues about money and finance along the way as well. But it's just having that open communication that is really good.
Well, along that kitchen table conversation, a majority of your work focuses on helping the entire family achieve financial freedom. How do you define financial freedom? Because the world we live in is very complex with the push and pull of where money is going in our lives.
Okay. It's a really, really deep question. I think there's one of the things I would say is financial freedom is the confidence and competency to set goals, strategize, have the discipline to wait and tolerate delayed gratification, and to achieve them and have success. Not all the time, but to, because you make mistakes, and but to learn from them. And I've identified five, what I consider of the most five important financial values that parents need to teach their children. You want me to tick those off?
Yes, please.
Okay. One is let them make trade-offs. Make them make trade-offs. So if they are doing back to school shopping or any kind of shopping trip, make a list. And then, you know, if they say, well, I want, you know, three pairs of hoodies instead of just one, say, well, let's put that on your wish list. And maybe you can't compromise underwear or socks, you know, but like instead of buying jeans for $50, maybe we'll find a pair on sale for $20. And then maybe you can afford one or two more hoodies.
Oh, so they make some compromises along the way.
Exactly. The second one is to help them understand the difference between wants and needs. It's okay to want things. We all want things, but you need to know if it's something you actually have to survive or to get by in life day to day. And so we used to play, when I was raising my son, the gotcha game. And every time we heard each other say, oh, I need something that we really don't need, we had to put a quarter in the jar. And that added up. And then we would do something fun together or donate it. This way, when I said, oh, I need a new red silk blouse, my son says, gotcha.
still playing the game. Let's bring in Sheila now in Wrightstown. Hi, Sheila.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have a question about my children both. We've been fortunate enough that my parents have been able to give them a lot of money. So they both have a lot of money in a bank account, and when they were younger, it was easy enough to just leave that in there and have it be part of their savings. As they get older, and of course they're aware of the fact that grandma and grandpa hand them this much money for Christmas every year, and they want some of that money to spend. And my mother would love for them to have some of that money to spend as well. She doesn't really like the fact that they have to put that all in the bank. So now I have a hard time with them being responsible with finances and trying to get them to understand that money just doesn't grow on the grandma and grandpa tree.
Mm. Jane, go ahead.
Yeah, that raises a couple of issues. First of all, how old are your children?
My daughter is 13 and my son is 10.
Okay. So they're still, I think, just young enough for you to be able to start them thinking about how to handle this really well and make decisions. And you can say, legally, it's still really my decision when you take money out and when you don't. But I would prefer that you learn how to make smart decisions, decisions that will help you be successful in life. And so why don't we sit here and dream a little bit about things that you wish you could have? And then, like, maybe there's a concert or a play that you want to go to, or maybe there's some movies you want to see with friends, or video games you want to download that I approve the content of, things like that, or clothes. And just say, and that's the other thing, you can say, you know what, you have so much money, I'm not going to pay for accessories anymore, or toiletries, or that's for you to pay. And that's forcing them to use the money for something practical, and say, I just want you to understand the difference between those wants and needs, and to make trade-offs, because you could blow it all today, but then, you know, you're going to not have it tomorrow when something maybe more important will occur to you. So that's number one. But number two is maybe to sit down with your parents and say, can we rethink this? I so appreciate that you give this money to my children, but maybe put it in a college account, a 529, or at least some of it, because it's really countermanding my parenting efforts to teach them financial values.
Sheila, thanks so much for the call. In the 1960s, researchers at Stanford University conducted the so-called marshmallow test on four-year-olds. It's all about the rewards of delayed gratification. We all need to develop the ability to wait for what we want. We're talking kids and money on this edition of On Your Money. Jane Pearl stays with us. Her book is Kids, Wealth, and Consequences. She's been a financial journalist for decades. Join in with your questions, your philosophies on teaching children about money at 800-642-1234. At what age do you think children should be taught financial responsibility? How do you approach allowance? Call in, email onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll be right back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Kids between the ages of 4 and 14 received an average of $454 in allowance over the course of last year. That was on top of cash gifts for birthdays and holidays. That's according to an allowance tracker survey from the app Rooster Money. The average kids takes home about $8.74 a week. We're talking about kids and money on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author and journalist Jane Pearl is our guide. Her book is Kids, Wealth, and Consequences. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think parents should let kids be kids or teach them about money management and the value of a dollar early on? What strategies do you use to teach your children financial responsibility or good money habits? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go back to the phones now with Paula joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, when my kids are grown now, but when my kids were young, I would give them a clothing allowance. I think you alluded to this earlier. I'd give them X number of dollars, and then they each season, and then they would have to use that money to buy the needs, you know, the coats, the boots, the swimming suits. But then if they wanted like a Nike shirt or Under Armour shirt, things that were a little bit above my budget, they'd have to either get less shirts or they'd have to work, do some extra chores around the house to be able to afford those. I also, like if they wanted a Game Boy or if they wanted a game system, I knew I'd give them X number of dollars for their birthday or Christmas, and then if that was what they wanted was more expensive, then they would just have to come up with the money on their own.
Paula, how did that situation work out for you? Did it seem to be a good two-way street? Did you stick with it?
I think I stuck with it pretty well. It was good. The downside to that was, as far with like the extra chores, then they felt like everything, if I asked them to do something, it would be, do I get money for this? Do I get money for that? And I didn't like that part. I had to kind of, you know, there were some things that was like you just did because there were certain chores they had to do just because they were a part of the family and the household. And then there were extra chores. So there was chores that they did without getting paid that they would just do for being a part of the family. And then there were other chores that they could, you know, they could do extra for extra money. And I thought it worked pretty well. I think it made them think about, you know, watching the sales like you had kind of talked about earlier. Watching, they just didn't get, you know, all the money they wanted to get whatever they wanted. They had to kind of...
Oh, they were became more scrutinizing as consumers themselves.
Yeah, or rummage sales or whatever, right. You know, if they wanted something, then they were... and then some of them were, you know, some of them didn't care so much about whether they had name brand clothes, and, you know, some of them... did. So then it was like, yeah, you gotta work a little harder then, I guess, if that's what, you know, if that's what you want to wear.
Let's bring in
any left over.
Yeah,
use it for whatever they want to choose. So
yeah, let's bring in Jane with insights. What do you make of this?
Paula, I am really impressed because I think you did everything right. It seems like it worked out pretty well. You were clear. You set the boundaries for what kind of chores they do just because they're members of a household and what extra things they could do to earn some extra money. You were consistent. And I don't know about the consequences, but I think you just let it. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the money. And that's an important, important lesson. So I think, and also it forces them to do several things. One is to tell themselves no, which is one of the five financial values that I was talking about before. And it helps them tolerate delayed gratification by forcing them to save up, to do some work for things that they want. You know, when kids fail in life, it's usually because they have no hope for the future. They don't have confidence that they can set goals and meet them. And one of the powers of these programs, of using this allowance program and these shopping schemes, is that it really helps hammer in that they can be successful. It just takes work. They're not going to be handed everything, but they have power. They have control over their lives. The other thing is that, you know, you talked, Kate, about that they would be more scrutinizing about what they purchased. And that's exactly right, because one of my friends was complaining to me that her teenage daughter every year wanted a new winter coat, no matter whether the other one fit or was, in good shape. And once she gave her, I said, give her a clothing allowance and force her to make her own decisions. All of a sudden, she didn't need a new coat.
She had other things that she wanted to do with the allowance?
Yeah, and sometimes she chooses to save some of it. That's the other thing. When you give a budget for a shopping trip, you can give them an incentive to make wiser decisions by saying, whatever's left over, you can put in the bank.
Well, but not, I mean, just a bit of pushback here. Children are bombarded with pretty sophisticated news, advertising, and then there's the layer of peer pressure that is huge. How can parents help teach children how to develop a healthy skepticism, but also understand that kids are up against a whole lot of pressure from both advertisers and their own peers?
Yeah, that's very true. And one of the things is to simply watch television with your children and look at the ads and say, you know, that announcer said that pretty quickly, and I couldn't even understand what he said. Why do you think that was? Because the rest of the commercial was very clear. And you can say that's usually some what's called disclaimers, like, you know, this product could be dangerous or may break or whatever, doesn't come with battery. I remember when my son was 3.5, he came running to me all excited about this toy, and he goes, and battery's not included, because the announcer had said it as if it was a positive. So it's, you know, and to demystify these things, to tell them, remember when we went and we bought that thing that you really wanted and it broke the minute we got home? Well, it would have been better if, you know, and that commercial made it seem like it was so cool and such high quality. So we have, you know, it's, let's learn what lessons, this thing brought up. And I remember when I brought, this, and I didn't save the receipt, and I couldn't return it after it broke. So there's lots of ways to impart those messages. But yeah, developing a healthy skepticism is really, really important. And one of them is, one of the ways to do that is not just watching television, but relating stories about mistakes that you've made, which is very powerful for kids to hear.
Let's bring in Cynthia now in Menominee. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I have an anecdote to share about how we taught our kids the value of money, and they learned it well. First of all, we're lucky enough to have our own business that they started working for pay in the business about 8 years old enough to clean up the work site. But our son was a high school junior, just made varsity basketball, but the team had voted to wear black shoes the following season. We had just bought him a pair of shoes for $100 because we would spend that money for athletic shoes. Otherwise, I'd say, you know, it's not worth that much. But he came home and told me and said, I have to buy new shoes. And I said, if you think I'm going to pay $100 for a pair of shoes simply because yours are the wrong color, no. And I came home one day from work, and he is sitting on the couch coloring in his shoes with black magic marker. And years later, one of his teammates recited, yeah, he would sit downstairs in the locker room and repaint his shoes every once in a while, give them a touch-up. And they also would, the kids would also say, well, if I pay half for this, will you pay half? And sometimes I would, and sometimes I'd say, you know, it's just not worth that extra money. We can get this for less.
How did it work, Cynthia, for your kids to work in the family business?
They learned a work ethic like you wouldn't believe. And when my son graduated from college and went into the work world looking for a job, he'd hand them their resume and listing the years he'd worked in the business, and they say, yeah, right, you were 10 when you started working or 8 when you were started working. He says, yeah, I was. Allowances were given because it's a part of the family income. I didn't pay anything to them for working around the house because that's what you do to take care of things. And you know what? My daughters-in-law really thank me.
Cynthia, thank you so much for the contribution. Jane, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you did a great job, Cynthia. And a lot of what you did was telling them no. That's very hard for parents to do because they feel like they're depriving their precious children. But yet when they say yes, they feel guilty for indulging them. So what's the alternative? Putting the decision or certain decisions in your children's hands more and more as they get older and more responsible to tell themselves no because they have trade-offs to make. So I think that's really important. I'm very happy to hear that parents are doing things like that.
Jane, one of your 5 financial values is delayed gratification. How can parents help children develop that ability to tolerate delayed gratification?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the marshmallow test at Stanford University, and they followed those children. First of all, they took children who were 4 years old, and they put them in a room. They gave them each one marshmallow, and they said, you can eat it now, but I'm going to go and get another bag. I'll be right back. And when I come back, those of you who have not eaten the first marshmallow will get a second one. But those who have eaten that marshmallow, I'm sorry, you won't get another one. So they tracked who did what, and they just, by definition, those who ate the marshmallow had difficulty delaying gratification. And they followed those children for 14 years. When they were 18, they found that the children who ate that marshmallow, who could not delay gratification, not only did they have higher at-risk behaviors, including drug abuse, teen pregnancy, crime, they also scored an average of 200 points less on their SATs. There is something about the ability to delay gratification that is a real predictor of success in many areas of life. So how do you teach that? You know, you can't just do the marshmallow test, although you could do that and see how they do and how hard you have to work. But things like, let's do a little test. Let's get some instant pudding and let's make some from scratch at home and compare the taste. What do you think? I think most of people would love the ones that are homemade, but some might like that kind that you shake and just it's instant. You can plant a garden and say, we buy vegetables, but we can grow some of our own. And it takes longer, but look how much fun it is and how proud we are when we get the results. So I think those are ways to do it. And also just to, when you're saying no, you have to save up for that. That's forcing them to delay some gratification.
Let's bring in James now, joining us from Lakefield, Michigan. Hi, James.
Good morning. A lot of great ideas on savings for the kids and whatnot, but the whole premise of a kindergartner paying rent is absolutely ridiculous. That young person should be read to and learn how to read, learn how what's right and wrong and how to be nice to friends, and should be outside playing and sharing toys. Paying rent? Give me a break. Not a kindergartner. I think it's ridiculous.
James, thanks for bringing that to the table. James is saying there are so many other values that that kindergartners should be learning.
I agree. I think that, I laugh. It is ridiculous in all sorts of ways, but I still think that this mother's conscious effort to impart financial literacy and competence and discipline and values is probably being reflected in other things that she's doing creatively to impart those, you know, other values to her daughter. But I agree. I wouldn't choose to do this with my kid. But, you know, it's very personal decision how parents choose to pay attention. The very fact that she is paying attention to these issues, I think, is good. Another thing is, why not play? I think the game of life is recommended for children ages 8 and up. And there's a lot of lessons and discussions that can emanate from playing that game together. I think that, again, I said earlier that basing allowance on financial responsibilities that are more age appropriate. School lunch. If your child pays for school lunch, you can give them the option to say, you know, you can keep, what is it, $3 a day, let's just say? You can keep $3 every day that you choose the night before to make a healthy lunch to take to school.
And I think Fred in Coon Valley might want to speak to that point. Fred, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's funny, that's the exact point that I was making. When I started in junior high school, my mother started giving me an allowance, and that allowance was to take care of needs and wants, and then there was an additional amount to pay for school lunch. And she said, if you make your lunch at home and take your lunch, you can save that money that you would pay for lunch and instead use it for the needs and wants that you have, whether it would be clothes or going to a sports game at the school or whatever. And so then I took advantage of that, and I did that. And it taught me something else, because I started to realize that, well, it wasn't that the food was free. My mother was paying for the food that was in the refrigerator. And so then I developed a plan, or I had the idea, that I'd go and help the cooks during the lunch hour. And then the reward for that was I got to eat for free. Or I was earning my lunch, so to speak. So then not only was I not spending money for lunch and I had more money for my needs and wants, but then my mother, you know, wasn't watching me eat every single egg with egg salad or tuna salad or take all the fruits and vegetables and bread out of the house.
Well, Fred, you became a natural-born entrepreneur at that point.
And I also developed an appreciation for cooks, because if the cook ever said, could you please lift this heavy bag down or do this or this, I always said yes, because then when my shift was done, they might have an extra fish sandwich for me or something, saying, hey, you know, you worked so hard and we weren't sure if you had a chance to eat earlier.
Fred, thanks so much. Jane, a young entrepreneurial spirit through these lessons and insights that Fred learned at an early age.
I love it. I just love it. Kids, when they are given the opportunity to spread their wings, and the incentive to make money, and how amazing that Fred was able to say, not just me, I want to help out with the family expenses. I just think it's remarkable. But I look at all the values that were imparted just in the parents saying, you know, you can take the lunch, you can keep the money for the lunch if you make it. He's understanding the difference between wants and needs. He's making trade-offs. He's telling himself no in terms of spending, and he's delaying gratification by having to make lunch instead of just getting it instantly, or as he chose, to earn his lunch. Fantastic.
A study 5 years ago by Cambridge University found that people form many of their financial habits by age 7. literally by the time they're in second grade. We're having a conversation about kids and money with journalist Jane Pearl. She's been writing about financial literacy for several decades, gathering your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. How do you teach kids about financial realities? What valuable lessons do you teach your children about money? How did your parents teach you about financial responsibilities? And did it stick? Did it work? Call in, email onyourmoney@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing teaching kids sound financial habits on this edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is away. Author Jane Pearl is our guide. She's co-author of Kids, Wealth, and Consequences, Your Questions, Your Approaches to Teaching Young People the Value of a Dollar at 800-642-1234. At what age do you think children should be taught financial responsibility? Do you think parents should let kids be kids or teach them about money management and the value of a dollar early on? Call in, email at onyourmoney@WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones now with Mona waiting in Sun Prairie. Good morning, Mona.
Hi, good morning. One thing I taught our son, he's 51 now and still talks about this. He was about six, I think. He had a little car that had a skinny piece of plastic that you inserted in the back and then pulled it out, and then the wheels would turn and you put the car down and away it would go. And he loved that thing. And eventually he lost that little piece of plastic. And rather than go out and immediately throw the car away and buy a new car, we decided the car, there's nothing wrong with the car. He just needs that piece of plastic. And he thought maybe he could ask the company how much it would cost just for that piece of plastic, because it would cost less than the car. And so I gave him paper, and he wrote a letter himself and put a little drawing in it saying what he needed and how much would it cost, and mailed it off. I think it was to Mattel. And lo and behold, a couple weeks later, he gets the little piece of plastic in the mail, and there's no charge. And he's got his car, and he is, like, thrilled. And he learned a very valuable lesson that it's just not disposable. You could fix things.
And it's beautiful that the company responded to him.
I was shocked. I really didn't expect them to.
Jane Pearl, your thoughts?
I think that's great. It's really interesting that he found out that if you advocate for yourself, sometimes you're rewarded. I mean, it could have been a very different outcome, but either way, there's a lesson there. You know, you try. If you don't ask, you don't get. And instead of just being in disposing things that don't work initially, try to fix it. And sometimes that means writing to the company. But what a great lesson that he took the time. It was a little bit more delayed gratification, but I think he probably felt so much self-esteem having accomplished something like that. And that is a big thing. I think parents think that self-esteem comes from telling your kids they can do no wrong, just complimenting them for every little thing, whether they were responsible for that success or not. But it's not. It's really helping them, setting them up to make mistakes and learning from them so that when they have a success, it's very powerful. And I remember my son is a musician. He's a traveling musician. And when he was little, it was clear that's what he was going to do. And he wanted a guitar when he was six. So I bought him one and got him lessons. And then he wanted another guitar when he was about eight. And I said, well, you know, I understand you're not studying classical music now. You're studying more kind of like rock and folk. So why don't you, you're going to have to pay for half of it. And then he was a teenager. He wanted an electric guitar. I said, you're on your own. Well, he saved a year and a half for that guitar. And when he took it home, he threw himself on the bed crying. And I said, oh, my God, buyer's remorse? And he says, no, I'm just so excited. He was just overwhelmed. Mm. Now, he would have loved that guitar if I'd bought it for him outright. I could have afforded to buy that for him. But what a lesson that he had to strategize. He had to wait and wait and wait. And now he felt so successful at having accomplished such a goal that was so important to him.
Mona, thanks. Let's go to Susan now, joining us from Fitchburg. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I come from Depression-era parents who were always teaching us to save money, and that gives away my age a little bit because I'm a baby boomer. But the thing I think back on is that when we were told always to save money, there was never really any option of what saving it for something that we really valued or really wanted. And I think it's good that you're incorporating that into your discussion, because I think of things that I really wanted as a child, but I wasn't given the option of, well, you can save for it, or you can forego something else to get the thing you really want. So even now as an adult, I think back on some of those things that I wanted as a child, and I still want them today.
Well, Susan, it's really interesting you bring up the Depression, because Jane Pearl, your book came out very soon after the Great Recession, where so many families were feeling the depths of that. And, you know, your insights there, and have we swinged the other way now?
Well, I don't think we should swing the other way. I think that, Susan, it's unfortunate that your parents, I mean, it's great that they taught you how to save, but yeah, it wasn't really purposeful or strategic. And so it's good that you recognize that, and I hope it hasn't stopped you from learning how to spend. There are kids who naturally, one of my friends has two children. One, you give her a dime, she spends 20 cents. The other one, you give him 10 cents and he's gonna save it, and he'll never spend on anything. Although he's very good at manipulating his parents into spending for him. So you don't want to be raising little manipulators. You don't want to be raising people who are tightwads. You want to have them learn how to spend, but responsibly and strategically. And again, go with their desires and their dreams and help them reach them. Help them strategize to reach them, instead of it's giving them a fish versus teaching them how to fish.
And it's perhaps very difficult for Susan to carry over some of those very firsthand, difficult depression era situations to a generation that is a world away from that.
Exactly. But we're not a world away from financial crisis of, you know, the more recent ones. And I'm sure a lot of parents, whether or not they lost their jobs or homes, have friends whose parents did. And it's very scary, and it raises a lot of issues about how much you divulge. And my opinion is that the more secretive you are, the more your kids will imagine things even worse, because they're going to sense the stress that parents feel when they have financial difficulties. But you want to make it, again, age appropriate. So you don't tell a 5-year-old, oh my God, we might lose our house. But you can say, you know, things are a little more difficult in the world these days, and we're going to be careful and smart and find ways to save. And so getting kids to help you strategize about that is very powerful, and again, teaches them some important lessons. So instead of movie night and going out to dinner, you might say, let's make pizza at home and watch a DVD or Netflix or Prime, and maybe we could put a few bucks in the vacation jar that we would have spent, and that way we have money for a better vacation. So there's so many ways to do that. And the idea is also, you want to gimme-proof your kids. You just don't want them to feel entitled to everything. And it's very hard in this economy and in this society and culture to do that. One thing that's really powerful to help gimme-proof your kids is what I call the cost of cool. And to just go in your kids' closets and drawers and say, look at all the stuff we bought last year that you don't wear, and how much we spent just because it had to be the right color or style, and now you don't even use it. So add that up, and you'll see your kids' eyes bug out and say, so when we go on our next shopping trip, we're going to be a lot more careful.
Susan, thank you so much for bringing that to the conversation. Let's go to Rob joining us in Sandstone, Minnesota. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I grew up in a family of 10, and basically started working when I was in kindergarten, washing, you know, friends' cars, and then I had a paper route, and then I got a job in high school as part of my high school, and basically had to work my way. But it basically taught me how to work, and my parents, you know, barely, we weren't wealthy, so we had a lot of wealthy friends, but who got more of the style of clothes and stuff like that. But I had hand-me-downs, whatnot. But ultimately, a lot of those folks grew up and had a lot of problems later, and, you know, drugs, alcohol, whatever. Basically, they just didn't know how to work and how to manage their lives in a way when they got on their own. And but I'm still friends with a lot of them, and they made it through that. And all 10 of us made it through to a pretty decent life. I don't know how we all turned out okay, basically, but we had our struggles with the you know, poor being poor, basically.
Yeah.
But we all got somewhat educated and things like that.
Rob, thank you so much. And Jane, he brings an interesting point to the conversation. Growing up in a very large family and the financial responsibilities and what you learned from that.
Absolutely. I think also that having to, you know, having great wealth and access to that wealth at a young age and being given everything really robs a child of a sense of purpose and gives them an unrealistic sense of entitlement that could really negatively impact relationships, both personal, romantic, and professional. For instance, if you don't have to work, you're not going to be as tolerant on the job of little annoying things that you have to learn how to deal with in life. You'll just quit or get fired because of your attitude. So it's really, and then what does that do to your sense of self-esteem? So it's really a good idea, no matter how much money the parents have, to help the kids, force the kids to have to earn some and manage some and make those trade-offs.
Well, as we have only about a minute left with you, what are some easy, painless ways perhaps children can learn how to pay for college and take this money they're earning in their allowance and graduate with little to no debt, if possible?
Right. Well, especially parents in the middle and lower end of the economic spectrum may feel like it's just in this day and age almost impossible to save for college. And we see what's happening with all the financial debt, the student debt. So telling your kids that maybe community college for a couple of years and then go to the school of your dreams, maybe work summers, work all through high school to help save. If you've got a family business, like I guess that was Cynthia, have them work in the family business and put that money or some of that money in a college savings account.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Mine too.
Jane Pearl is a journalist focusing on family business and financial parenting. She's co-author of the book Kids, Wealth, and Consequences, Ensuring a Responsible Financial Future for the Next Generation. She's former senior editor of Family Business Magazine, to which she's contributed for more than 20 years. Her website is kidsandmoney.com. Kevin McKinley will be back next week. This edition of On Your Money was produced by Nyasia Ellison, Colleen Leahy, and Brianne Shasso. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.